You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. In his book Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, author Matthew Desmond exposed the tenuous and often invisible lives of poor residents of Milwaukee. It won him the 2017 Pulitzer Prize. In a recent piece for the New York Times, Desmond compares the experiences of renters and homeowners across the country and examines the policies that have made the gulf between those who own and those who rent one of the greatest divides in our country. You can find a link to that article on the Central Time Facebook page. Matthew Desmond is an associate professor of the social sciences and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard University. He received his PhD in 2010 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, Matthew, let's start with the mortgage income deduction. Could you tell us what it is and where it first came from?
It's called a mortgage interest deduction.
Sorry, interest,
and
correct.
What it is a entitlement for all homeowners in America who itemize their deductions, and they can deduct all the interest they pay on their first home up to $1 million, and on their second home up to, I think, $100,000. They can deduct that interest and save quite a bit on their tax returns. It wasn't intended to be an enormous entitlement is what it became. It started in 1913 as a general policy that allowed businesses to deduct all interest. But that was a time where most Americans didn't pay income tax, and it's a time where most Americans didn't own their homes. And as that changed over the 20th century, the mortgage interest deduction became one of the biggest, most generous deductions in the tax code. And the most recent data suggests that, it cost us about $71 billion last year. And if you add that up to other homeowner subsidies, the price tag for this benefit is about $134 billion. So it started as something of an accident, but became something that's just fundamental to the American welfare state.
Who benefits the most from that today?
So you can claim a bigger deduction if you have a bigger mortgage, and obviously you can get a bigger mortgage if you have a bigger income. So the folks that benefit the most from this entitlement are affluent families, and so about 4/5 of the entire deduction from the mortgage interest deduction go to families with six-figure incomes. That's a big benefit going to upper-income families. And there's also racial and economic differences here because legacies of racial discrimination. Most white families today own their own home, but most African-American and Hispanic families don't. And so most white families are entitled to this deal, but most non-white families are not.
And you say that we should think about the mortgage interest deduction the same way we think about, for example, Medicaid. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's just it's a big entitlement. It costs a lot of money. And it's been seen for years and years as this kind of third rail of politics, kind of this untouchable benefit that is just going to lose you a bunch of political points if you try to take it on. So it's become something like Medicaid in its ability to withstand all kind of political transitions. And it was only altered once in its entire history.
And you write about it in the sense, though, that we may be thinking about people who get government money, maybe entitlements, as the sort of welfare queen idea from the Reagan era. But you say this is analogous with that at the same fundamental level.
It's important. I think it's important to think about the welfare state in really big terms. And I think that, like I said in the piece in the Times magazine, a 15-story public housing complex and a mortgaged suburban home, they're both government-subsidized housing, but only one looks that way, And we tend to benefit middle-class and upper-class Americans through the tax code, and we tend to benefit Americans of modest means by writing checks or building buildings. And I just think it's important that when it comes to what we're spending on housing today, the biggest beneficiaries are not low-income families, but are the affluent homeowners.
I want to talk about this on a personal level, and that's what you did. You talked to a number of families, and you looked at how this was playing out in their lives and the lives of their children. Can you tell us about a couple of these families, some of who maybe were the beneficiaries of the mortgage interest deduction and those who were renters without that?
Sure. So one of the families I met, the lead person I spoke to was a guy named Vinny. And Vinny was a middle-income homeowner. He lived in a suburb of Boston. He and his new wife had a little baby at home, and they're first-time homeowners. And they itemize their deduction, so they do claim the mortgage interest deduction. And so this is kind of what we want, right? We want young families starting an nest egg, getting into homeownership situation, but he didn't get that much of a benefit from this. You know, he basically saved a little less than $40 a month from the mortgage interest deduction. Now, compare Vinny to another family I met who lives in Milton, Massachusetts, which is a Asari family. Now, the Asari family, they're better off. They're upper middle class. You know, their combined income is about $10,000 shy of $300,000 a month. And they have a four-bedroom home. It's their second home. And through the mortgage interest deduction, their claim is just under $400 a month. You know, so it's a big difference by what the Asari family receives from this benefit and what a family like Vinny receives from the benefit, even though the Asari family arguably needs it a lot less than Vinny does. And then for me anyways, a really important part of the story is just to think of the one-third of Americans, the one-third of renting households that are just completely left out of this bargain. And I think that a lot of Americans, when we think of the typical low-income family, we think of them living in public housing or benefiting from some other kind of assistance from the government, like a housing voucher. But the opposite is true. Only about one in four of all families in America who qualify for housing assistance get it. So the majority, the unlucky majority of renting families receive zero help from the government. And if they're below the poverty line, most of them spend at least half of their income on housing costs today. So for me, what we have in America is a housing policy that gives most help to families that arguably need it the least and gives no help to most families that need it the most.
We're talking with Matthew Desmond right now from Harvard University, talking about his New York Times Magazine piece called How Home Ownership Became the Engine of American Inequality. By the way, you can read that on the Central Time Facebook page. And Matthew, why has owning a home become such a bedrock of a way that a family might accumulate wealth over the years?
So homeownership has always been seen as deeply American, and it's been seen as something that our founding fathers knotted up with citizenship. The very idea of what it means to be an American was, you know, embodied in this symbolic idea of the Yemen farmer, you know, sweating and toiling over his own piece of land. And that's part of our DNA. That's part of our national DNA. And but America hasn't always been a nation of homeowners. You know, this was really forged in the New Deal with things, especially like the GI Bill and the federal insuring of private mortgages that allowed many, many veterans and other folks to own their own home with very little money down and kind of use that as a foothold into the middle class. You know, owning a home is it's a savings compeller. When you're paying a mortgage, you're compelled to put something away. And in many markets, you know, your home is worth a lot more 5-10 years later than it is when you buy it. So, you know, the wealth differences between homeowners and renters are enormous. The average homeowner is 36 times better off when it comes to their net worth than the average renter in America.
Hmm. And you were talking earlier about how this has privileged white Americans over people of color all the way back to the GI Bill, when you had processes like redlining, which kept African Americans from getting those loans and owning homes.
It's an important part of our our history. And, you know, this is an argument that a lot of other folks have made. And in my piece, I draw off a wonderful book called When Affirmative Action Was White by the Columbia historian Ira Katznelson. And, you know, he articulates really clearly with a lot of proof how African-American veterans and families were excluded from New Deal policies that propelled many white families into the middle class. And I think that a lot of listeners, especially if they're young and they're my age, it's hard for us to, like, imagine how massive the GI Bill was. But it was this huge piece of social legislation. You know, in the years after World War II, it consumed, I think, 15% of the federal budget. I mean, this thing was colossal. And, you know, one of the big things it did was allow returning soldiers access to homeownership. So in the years following World War II, you know, 40% of home loans were veteran mortgages. You know, they had low interest rates. They were great. There was a great benefit. But the problem was, now, many African Americans were excluded both at the federal level and at the local level when it comes to implementation from benefiting from that benefit. You know, FDR had to contend with the Southern wing of the Democratic Party in Congress, so he made concessions, you know, and they were concessions that upheld the racial status quo. And, you know, if you were an African-American family that somehow still qualified for the GI Bill, you still had to contend often with local VA centers and other administrative organizations like banks, like you said, which also were loyal to Jim Crow. And so, you know, we directly inherit that history and that legacy. You know, most folks that buy their first home today, you know, they get help from their parents, right? And their parents often are able to give that help because they've saved and because they're able to refinance their home and pull out some equity to give to their children. And so I think that's an important thing to recognize when it comes to thinking about the inequality that this benefit amplifies.
Matthew Desmond stays with us right now as we talk about how the gulf between people who own their homes and those who rent illustrates some of the largest divides in the United States. And you can read his New York Times Magazine piece. It's called How Home Ownership Became the Engine of American Inequality on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you bought your own home, how'd you do it? Were you able to get that help from a family member? And how did they have the money to help if you trace that back far enough? Or if you haven't been able to buy a home, what's been standing in your way? Do you feel like you've been hurt over the years, maybe by race, maybe by employment or another factor in that process? And how much do you count on being able to get tax breaks passed on from owning your own home? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about how owning a home came to be part of the American dream, or at least the American aspiration, the hope, and why there's now such a huge gulf between people who own those homes and people who rent, and what it means for their economic futures. And we hope that you'll join us now at 800-642-1234. If you are renting, what struggles do you face? Are you renting by choice, or is buying a home outside of your reach? And have you ever been evicted or had your home foreclosed on? What led to that, and how has that impacted you? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take our first caller now. We have Jessica joining us in Milwaukee as we pick up with Matthew Desmond from Harvard University. Jessica, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. What did you want to share?
I just wanted to say a small comment that it's really great that we're talking about these, especially right now, because this summer is the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches in Milwaukee for fair and open housing. And we are still seeing such an amazing struggle and a large amount of disparity, particularly in Milwaukee housing, both in rentals and in home buying. And so it's just amazing that 50 years later, we're still in this position. I can take any sort of response off the air.
Jessica, thank you. And Matthew, what do you say to that?
It's an important point. And, you know, Milwaukee is a city that had an open housing struggle that failed. And the city remains an incredibly segregated and divided city today. And for me, you know, writing this piece and trying to understand the link between benefits that affluent homeowners get and the lack of benefits that so many renters get, and how that traces along lines of poverty, lines of racial division, is important, you know, because it shows that, you know, we are all connected here, you know, and the only road to real reform, as is some folks that have a little more, share a bit off their plate. There's no other road to reform, and the open housing marches that crossed the Menominee Valley in Milwaukee 50 years ago recognize that fact. And I think that we as a nation need to start having a larger conversation, a searching conversation, about how the benefits that we claim on our tax records and how our neighborhoods and how our schools are directly connected to underperforming neighborhoods or underperforming schools or the lack of benefits that some of our neighbors receive or don't receive.
Jessica, thank you so much for that. And I want to get back to callers, but Matthew, I wanted to ask you, you said that Washington hasn't had on either side of the aisle an appetite for the kind of reform that you're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is?
Well, it's really tough to reform a benefit that's baked into the budgets of so many Americans, and not just any Americans. These are typically Americans that make up the voting base of both parties, you know, of both parties. And so even certain politicians who are on the progressive side of things and support legislation to combat inequality, those politicians often find themselves on the coast, you know, like Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco, and have been very reluctant to go after a benefit that disproportionately benefits their constituents. So that's one thing. And the other thing to recognize is just, you know, the real estate lobby is very powerful. And when we think of lobbies in Washington, I think we often think of the NRA gun lobby, big pharmaceutical lobbies, and they clearly are a force. But the realtors are much bigger spenders. They were second only to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in terms of spending last year. They spent almost $65 million would be incredible, $65 million on lobbying efforts last year. And so they're a well-organized, well-heeled, powerful group, and they support the mortgage interest deduction and other homeowner subsidies.
Let's take another call. We've got Matt next in Stevens Point. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
I just wanted to share a small thought here. I mean, home ownership, according to Desmond, there's more to it. You know, I'm burdened with a township tax that far exceeds what I would get back in my interest deduction. And I mean, that among other things, the cost of owning a home, yard work. I have a home out in the country. I was blessed with a family that did help me get started. So he has a good point there. You know, the wealth is transferred, but it's not just it's not money for nothing. You know, there's a lot of money to go into owning a home, and it's hard. It's a struggle every month for me to make my payments. And I'm a lower middle class guy, and I think every lower middle class citizen that owns a home would agree with me. It's hard to make that payment, and I think that should be a goal for everybody. And if you start taking away that deduction and make it harder to own a home, then you're starting to kill that goal for more than just the lower income families. I think it should start at home. People should be taught to strive to own a home.
Matt, thank you so much for your thoughts there. What do you say to that, Matthew? He's saying he needs that deduction. This is hard work owning a home, and it costs a lot of money.
I think Matt has a good point. And I would say for someone like Matt in a position like that, that, you know, the mortgage interest deduction isn't doing a lot for him. You know, and that's part of the issue. You know, it's doing a lot for folks that aren't struggling to make those payments. And it's doing a lot for folks that have homes that are worth $700,000, $800,000, $900,000. Dollars. That's where the benefit is really cashing in. And so what my piece suggests, it suggests a very modest modification to the mortgage interest deduction, which is to cap the amount that you can deduct at $500,000. And that, by some estimates, would only affect about 5% of all mortgages in the United States. But the savings would be colossal. By one estimate, we would save about $87 billion over the next decade. And if that money could be transferred to affordable homeownership, and even to be transferred to help Americans of modest means who do own their homes, that would be something that I think would make a lot of sense. And I think that would be a step in the right direction. I would say, you know, one thing that Matt brought up is, you know, the question, does this benefit incentivize homeownership? And the economic literature is pretty equivocal on the answer, and the answer is no. It doesn't help you become a homeowner, because the biggest obstacle to that is a down payment, you know, and this is not something that this benefit helps. What this benefit does do is incentivize us to buy bigger homes and more expensive homes than we could if it didn't exist. So it does inflate homeownership values, especially toward the top end of the mortgage market.
Matthew, thanks a lot for talking today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
That was Matthew Desmond, a sociologist at Harvard University, and he got his PhD in 2010 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you can find this New York Times Magazine article we've been talking about by Matthew called How Home Ownership Became the Engine of American Inequality. You can find that on the Central Time Facebook page.